Thanks for tuning in to Women in Product Marketing. I'm your host, Mary Sheehan with Adobe. For those of you that are new to the pod, we explore the world of product marketing through the lens of the women who run it at some of the fastest growing technology companies in the world. All right, let's do this. Welcome back to Women in Product Marketing. I'm your host, Mary Sheehan with Adobe. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Ashley Faust, the head of lifecycle marketing and portfolio at Atlassian. Ashley has lead product marketing roles at Atlassian, startups, and more, and I cannot wait to get into the conversation today. Welcome to the show, Ashley.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited about this.
I have been waiting for this for a long time. So excited to have you here. And to start, can you take us back to a moment in your career when you had to step outside of your comfort zone? So I'd love to hear what that experience was like.
Since we're talking about being a woman in product marketing, I'll step back to building the Associate Product Marketing Manager program at Atlassian. So this was a program we have been fortunate to grow as a marketing organization and realized that we wanted to bring on some new grad talent and help guide them and launch their careers in product marketing. And so I was tasked with building this program. And that is not something I had done before. I've managed direct teams. I've managed people who were early in their career all the way up to senior career level, but I had not actually done it in a programatized way across an entire organization and thinking holistically, not just about how do I mentor these APMNs on the work that I need them to do, but also, how do I prepare them to go out and be successful in other teams at Atlassian? And how can I make this a growth opportunity for some of our folks who want to move into people management positions at Atlassian, or for some of our more seasoned product marketers to take on more of a strategy role by pairing with somebody from an execution standpoint? And so that was a scenario where it was just thinking through multiple levels of growth across the organization, both from a skills perspective and then also from kind of a people leader perspective. I was thrilled with the cohort we were able to hire. We got great talent and super excited. We saw a lot of mentorship growth, not just craft growth among the APMNs, but also mentorship and strategic growth among the folks that they were partnered with.
That's so amazing. And did I speak to them? I think I spoke
to them. That's so cool. So it's funny. This is like the full circle or meta thing where one of the APMNs, I asked them, I'm like, who would you all like me to bring to speak to you about product marketing? And one of the APMNs was like, I listened to this gal, Mary's podcast, Women in Product Marketing. I was like, I think I'm connected to Mary on LinkedIn / I've heard the podcast. And so yeah, Mary very kindly came and spoke to our cohort. We bought your book on product launches to all of them. And then you and I connected and now I'm on the podcast. So it's like,
I love it. And what a wonderful program that will go on for generations potentially of product marketers at your company too. That's so incredible. I was able to be affiliated with one at a past company, but I'm building one from the ground up. That's really, really something. And I bet those people really appreciate it. So glad to meet you then. And so glad to have you back on here now.
Exactly. It's fun.
All right. Well, before the show, we were talking a little bit about your new role and kind of the intersection of it with product marketing. So I'd love to hear more. And I think this is a really good episode to talk about some of the things you can do outside of product marketing that are really connected. So I'd love to hear more about your current role.
So I recently moved into this role in lifecycle marketing. And it's always funny when people look at my career and they're kind of like, you have done a lot of things and how does that all work together? And I would consider myself to be a marketing generalist. I know some people don't like to identify as a generalist versus a specialist, but for me, I think it really does encompass the skill set. And so that ability to think holistically about the audience journey and all of the different touch points, all of the different channels, and all of the different goals. From a product marketing standpoint, you really are focused on getting people into the product, enabling them to stay and see success in the product so that they will renew, right? That is kind of the core of product marketing, in my opinion. Lifecycle marketing takes a more holistic view all the way from awareness, sometimes even partnering from a brand perspective. How do we get them aware of Atlassian, not just aware of a specific product or aware of a specific use case? And so in my case, I'm actually kind of acting as that connective tissue between how do we think across the portfolio We're also in the process of expanding into being more solution-minded. So how do we attract people not just to Jira or just to Confluence, but to the entire suite of products to help them be successful? And how do we do that at different depths, in different channels, and at different points in the life cycle? So most of our life cycle marketers have expertise in specific areas of the journey or specific channels. They partner very closely with our paid folks. They're very skilled in, you know, email and advertising and some of our event marketing as well. Product marketing is very skilled in terms of the message, the audience, the product proof points to prove out that message to specific audiences. And so my team kind of sits in the middle to help bridge that gap to say, how do we make sure that we're delivering the right message to the right people at the right time in the right way? And then how do we also push the envelope on what right way means in terms of asset types, new channels we could be exploring, and the intersection of paid and organic?
That's so amazing. Would you also consider your role to be go-to-market? Is that another title you could have had within the role?
I think so. It's interesting because we kind of debated about what the title should be and where it should sit. And I think this is actually an interesting discussion. You know, your Adobe is a huge company as well, right? And like how you think about organizing the different portfolios and the different audiences and the different crafts within marketing. It's hard when you're a big company because a lot of what I'm doing now was in my remit when I was in product marketing. And some of the stuff I'm doing from a CLM perspective has a very product marketing bent to it. And so I actually think this function could sit in a variety of places in a large org, depending on the gaps that you're trying to fill, the metrics that you're trying to drive, and how you're trying to think holistically about the talent in the org. So it's interesting. I don't actually know if we have like a generic go-to-market title. I think we do tend to have more umbrella specific, you know, lifecycle marketing or product marketing, brand marketing, customer marketing, et cetera.
That makes sense. Yeah, it does. I think at a different companies, you could call that go-to-market too, but it's so important to get right. And it's such an important partnership with product marketing to make sure that the message, the positioning, like you were talking about, the audience understanding all gets to that right person at the right time in the right channel. And a lot of complication, especially at those big companies. So I'm so excited for this new remit for you and can't wait to hear more about it.
Yeah.
You also have a really perfect background for this. So we were catching up before. You've worked at content creation companies like Duarte, which I used to be a client of, and you have a lot of interest and passion for content marketing and product marketing. So I wanted to talk a little bit about, you just mentioned your new job. How do you do this? How do you actually adapt these messages for the right audience using those different assets and channels? What's your approach?
I'm still figuring that out, full disclosure. I think there's one interesting thing is like how I personally do it, right? Versus building a team and building systems to really scale that across the org. I think one key that has been helpful, and I would say this from like an org structure standpoint, having somebody who goes horizontally across. So even when I sat in product marketing, I went across the entire portfolio. All of my metrics were not tied to a specific product. They were tied more holistically to the portfolio. So that gave me the ability to think about areas where there might be overlaps in either the audience or overlaps in the product value props or something like that. So I was doing a lot of work in Agile and DevOps, which is for a more technical audience. And so Dev and Ops go together. That's like in engineering, they brought them together. We have a whole separate market for IT and ops. And so looking across those markets and saying, which of these stories lean into the dev forward lens versus the ops forward lens, for example, they're two sides of the same coin. So you might have an asset that gets positioned for one audience with a dev forward lens or dev forward language. That same audience or that same asset could be adapted to a more ops focused lens. So if we were to translate that to product marketing versus CLM, right? From a product marketing standpoint, I would probably speak more holistically about personas and onboarding flows, right? Versus on the CLM side, I would probably speak more about what are the channels where these segments are spending time or these cohorts are spending time, right? at the end of the day, you're talking about who are the people consuming this. But from a PMM perspective, you're talking more personas and product proof points to solve pains versus CLM. You're probably talking more about segmentation, channels, and accelerating them into those owned properties.
Got it. And so when you think about sort of the end result, you know, the right customer is seeing this message on a particular channel. So in one of these examples, you know, an IT professional is checking out this landing page that has a really specified offering. What are some of the tools or ways of approaching this do you recommend? Are you like spreadsheets for days that you keep everything organized, or do you approach it with channel plans, or what's the thought of, oh, getting this right content to that right person, the right segment? Person.
Yeah. So depending on the teams, we do have a mix of spreadsheets. We do keep some of this from like a launch and planning perspective in Jira Work Management and Confluence, which are two of our tools to do that. And then we're actually in the process of centralizing all of our teams on a digital asset management system. So getting those things out of all of the spreadsheets or out of the specific silos of different places where maybe if you're the content marketing team, you've got it in the content management system because that's where you're storing it. Or if you're the paid team, you've got your spreadsheet or your dashboards of different advertisements. So really making sure we're putting all of that in the central repository, tagging that with the campaign, tagging that with related assets. So this is the other piece of it that my role, my team is starting to help us get our arms around this across everyone, not just individual teams. And that's saying, if we have a campaign focused on, let's say, developer experience, and we know there's also some crossover with the ITSM service management side of the house, how do we tag that in the asset management system so that it's very obvious to any other marketers, whether that's creative, whether that's brand, whether that's product marketing, whether that's CLM, that they understand that these two things are connected and that one asset, depending on which lens it's taking, might actually be able to serve both audiences versus assets that are very specifically speaking to a core segment within a larger audience. So we're in the process of centralizing on those. We have brand folder as our digital asset management system. And then there's also the rituals side of it in terms of we use Atlas tickets, for example, for weekly updates on what's coming and using those for cross-functional teams, if we have stand-ups or we have a quarterly or monthly meeting of like, here's what's coming, here are the audiences that it's for, here's the campaigns that they roll up to.
That's awesome. And it also, you know, bringing something on board, this digital asset management obviously will help you track too and see if certain segments are utilizing all of these different things that you've created in better ways. I once worked at a company where I walked in the door. We had 16 verticals that we were focusing on. So 16. And they're like, yes, we need 16 blogs and 16 one sheets. And so I went through the same process and I said, let's figure out like what we're doing to host all of this and track it. And then there were those core assets that really went to the top. And we realized we didn't really need 16 versions of everything. That was something that every sales leader wanted for their particular vertical, but it's not something that was necessarily going to be really helpful in practice. Yes, for certain things like a buyer's guide, or if they're really down that decision funnel, I think that there are certain things that case studies, of course, are a really good example of that. But your State of the Union annual report that you have, that doesn't really need to be verticalized or certain webinars. So I love that you're thinking about it kind of like, hey, what are those marquee assets? Then what do we need to actually do for the segments, tracking it with all this? So cool. This is fun. I haven't gotten into the weeds with this in a while. So this is fun to talk about for me. Another topic I wanted to talk about with you is you have mentioned publicly that you focus more on this playground mindset versus the funnel mindset. What is this all about? Tell us more.
Yeah. So my quippy take on this is the funnel is dead, use a playground instead. Of course, everybody then wants to be like, what do you mean the funnel is dead? So my spicy take on this is basically that the funnel is a retrospective measurement tool, not a forward-looking strategy tool. And if you think about this intuitively, how many of us wake up and decide that we're in the consideration phase today? Like, nobody thinks that. Nobody goes on this linear journey where you see a post on LinkedIn about a tool and you click that link and it takes you to the website and you read the pricing and you're like, yes, why, in fact, I do have this problem, and you immediately convert. Like, that's not how it happens. So if we think about this like a playground, right? What's the right way to play on the playground? Is it to go slides, then swing, then merry-go-round? Is it to skip the merry-go-round altogether? What about the people who are sitting on the park bench? Are they using the playground the wrong way? And so if we start to think about the journey from that perspective, we realize that people can go up, down, and sideways. And so as a marketer, we need to create a smart and delightful journey that allows people to do that. So that's one element of the playground. The other element of the playground, which I always find funny, is using content the wrong way. And so what do I mean by the wrong way? Again, if we take this back to a literal playground, you're supposed to slide down the slide. My nephew always wants to go up the slide. Like every time, how do I climb up the slide? And if we think about that for our audience, they're the same way, right? So if we think about pricing as an example, that's traditionally considered a bottom of funnel or a decision-making conversation. But if I'm trying to get budget, I got to have a ballpark of pricing. And so I actually had this experience where I knew we had a problem. We decided that we were going to buy a tool to help us solve this problem. And my boss asked me, how much money do you need? We got to get this approved from a budget standpoint. So in theory, at the point where I was like reaching out to the sales rep, I looked like I was not even in their funnel because I hadn't done any research. I hadn't watched a webinar. I hadn't downloaded anything. There was no touch point that signaled to them that I was in the funnel. And right out of the gates, I'm like, hello, give me ballpark pricing because I actually need to go get budget. I literally can't be in the consideration or decision-making phase if I don't have any budget. So I managed to secure budget. I then reached out to a couple of the big players in the space and I'm like, hello, I'm trying to buy a tool. Sell me your tool. Why should I buy your tool? And I get on with a couple of them and they're like, in today's fast moving world, we need, and I was like, I don't think you understand. Here is my budget. I am trying to buy. I need to spend this money this quarter.
Yeah, skip the first callback.
Who are you? Why do I buy you, not somebody else, right? And they wanted me to go through and they're like, oh, here's a case study. I'm like, I don't care what other people have done. I'm bought in on the problem. I'm bought in on the solution. The question is, am I buying your solution or a competitor's solution, right? So it, just that flexibility to meet me where I was when I needed to get budget and then when I came in immediately ready to buy, that disconnect was huge. And it was fascinating to see. And this is where I think both from a CLM perspective, a product marketing perspective, and a sales perspective, what you put out is not for you. It's for your audience. And if your audience comes in ready to buy, sell them. If they come in and they're not trying to buy at all, don't sell them, right? Like match that content and match that journey to their intent. And you'll end up accelerating your pipeline and MQLs will actually be marketing qualified because they raised their hand. Sales will actually be able to close those deals because these people have a budget, timeline, decision-making authority, et cetera.
That is so great. I love this, not just because I have two toddlers and I'm just imagining them running amok on the playground every time we go, but it's so obvious. And it's like, why do we keep talking about the funnel in this way? And to your point, in your personal experience, why are we so inflexible if we're telling them, waving the money in their face, basically, that we're ready to buy? That's so interesting. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it does take quite a bit of rethinking the whole strategy, like you mentioned. And so serving up the right content, but also training the sales team to understand when someone's really serious. And hey, here's this choose your own adventure type of sales pitch where they don't want to hear slides 1 through 8 about the magical journey of your industry. Then let's skip that and go right to the money and right to the why you and the differentiation. And it kind of also begs the question, you should probably be talking about why you and differentiation through every stage too, every sales conversation early on. So, wow, that's really great. And you're such a great marketer that's like, hey, this makes sense. I'm just putting a term on it. Let's talk about this.
I love that. I think too, the other thing when you talk about some of the super tactical ways this comes to life, and particularly for product marketers, I hear a lot, we've convinced ourselves that learn intent content is best. Like, oh, we need to educate people. That's the best way. We don't want to sell them. We need to educate. And so things get twisted into being learn intent. So it's like, oh, we're going to teach people why they should buy our product. No, that's buy intent content. You're selling them something, right? Oh, we're going to show people how to use the product. No, you're going to, that's use intent content. That's not learn intent content, right? So when we think about that from a product marketing standpoint, when we put together our product tours, when we put together our CTAs, like my current rant is against the learn more CTA. I'm like, no more. What specifically is going to happen when I click this button? What specifically am I going to learn and how am I going to learn it? Am I going to watch a demo? Am I going to register for a webinar? Am I going to read an article? Like, what specifically happens when I click this button? And if I want to contact sales, like, make that button super obvious to me. Don't say learn more. Say contact sales, because you know if I hit that button, we're both aligned that the next thing I'm going to hit is buy intent content, right? So that's another interesting thing, I think. And this comes all the way from the awareness stage, right? If you're in the kind of CLM perspective and you're trying to show ads to somebody to just generally build awareness that we have a new product offering in a new space to a new segment, it's highly unlikely that somebody's going to click that learn more CTA that you have and immediately convert into the product. And so how do you bridge that gap between learn more about us versus learn more about the problem space versus learn more about how specifically to be successful in the product? Different teams own that piece, but we all have to work together because that learn more CTA gets real confusing real fast, right? Of what am I going to learn and how am I going to learn it?
This is really eye-opening. I hope a lot of marketers and sellers are taking note on this one. And actually thinking about my own experience, when I am reaching out to you, I have a budget in mind. I am like on a deadline to spend that money and I better be quick. So if I have to sift through a bunch of stuff, I'm like, I can't do that. I just need you to tell me. So this is great. Yeah, I think consumer, it's a little bit easier because you can have these different, not funnels, but different experiences and trials and things like that. But this is really cool. I like it. I'm on the playground mindset now, Ashley. This is,
I've converted you.
Conversion happened.
You've gone from awareness all the way into like buying. This is amazing. You bought my idea.
In 5 minutes. This is great.
5 minutes.
Love it. Well, great. Well, this is really fun so far. We're going to get into a couple of AMA questions from your recent AMAs. And then since you've already given us some spicy hot takes, the next section is on spicy hot takes. So sure, that will be really, really easy. So on the AMA, so these are all from a recent AMA that you did with ShareBird. And these were the top voted questions. But how should the approach differ for product launches targeted towards large enterprises versus one for smaller startups in terms of timelines, activities, and metrics? And you're in a new role now, but put on your product marketing hat. What do you say are the big differences here?
I think the biggest thing, a lot of enterprises have the resources to do the massive checklist of launches. They can do the blog, they can do the press, they can do multiple social media posts on multiple social media channels, they can activate their executives, they can throw a ton of paid spend at it, they can go to events, they can make it the thing for the booth at an owned event or a third party event, right? So I would say it's definitely, there's resource constraints. I would say between both of them that you should make sure you're doing the right things. Not all of those channels will be successful for you. And so we do have finite time. Even if you've got 10x the number of people or 10x the number of dollars, at some point you're going to hit your capacity limits. And so really being cognizant and matching those tactics to different tiers. So I think the tiers do apply to both what goes into them and how much you can support from a tiering perspective. Obviously, if you've got more money and more people, you can support more tiers. So that's the first thing that I'll say in terms of the number of activities that you can support and the tiers that you can support. That's one. The second thing that I'll mention is around like content repurposing, rolling thunder, et cetera. So for bigger companies, Atlassian's a perfect example. We have got multiple products across multiple markets. And so we are constantly shipping new features. And so for us, it's a lot more important to make sure that those features are matched properly to the launch tiers if it's like a brand new product that's like a game changer in the market, that's a tier one launch versus if it's a feature update or feature parity across some products or a patch or something like that, that would potentially not even be an actual launch. That might just be something that gets put in the release notes, or it might have one in-product message to just say, FYI, this is now available, right? Versus if you're a startup and you're not shipping as frequently, let's say you only have one product and maybe you've got a small team, so you're only able to ship once a month or once a quarter versus weekly or monthly or quarterly, whatever that cadence is, you're going to need to do more of a rolling thunder approach to be able to leverage that feature for longer. So we've done that even with some of our stuff where we'll try to batch some of the tier four like features into a larger story so that we can bump them up to a tier three or a tier two launch and tell that broader story versus if you're a startup and maybe you're going through a period, a very prolific period, you might want to actually go ahead and beat that drum every single week instead of batching it, just depending on how much stuff you're shipping. So that's what I'll say too, as you're thinking about like the tiering, the activities in each tier, and then the cadence, how much you want to lean into rolling thunder based on how prolific you are with shipping, and then how many of those features can actually tell a bigger story. So do you want to decompose them into more of a rolling thunder, or do you want to batch them into a bigger story? And you can do both. Like I say at Atlassian, sometimes we do both. We'll do a big bang and then we'll decompose it into a rolling thunder. And then maybe at the end of the quarter, we'll package it all up into a reminder of what we did, kind of a wrapped style, like here's all the cool stuff we shipped. And then we'll do a look back.
I love that. Yeah. And you can do that at companies big and small too. That's what's kind of the beauty of it. But yeah, I think we both have experience at small startups and big companies. And I love that you're saying the bigger companies just have the resources to have this huge launch checklist. I remember being introduced to this term at Adobe called the bill of materials. And I was like, oh, there are people that will help me with this. Oh, they have this whole bill of materials? Whoa. Because I think the secret is for launches at small companies, the company was at prior to Adobe, we did 100 feature launches in a year. How did I do it? Some launches were just a push notification or a customer email or an inclusion in a batch, like you were saying. It wasn't like 100 top tier launches in a year. So I think it depends. You still have to do the work on understanding what the feature is and messaging and positioning and all that, but it's lightweight depending. So I think, yeah, I love your take on kind of how to, depending on how much is on your roadmap, that also really dictates how much you're going to talk about this and how much of a big deal it's going to be and how much you can kind of rewind it and play it again. So that is really fun to hear. One more for you on launches. This is such a hot topic and a question that I will always want to ask everyone on the show, but what are the different ways to actually benchmark goals for a launch and also that kind of rolling thunder, that optimization post-launch? So how do you know if your launch was successful and what's the process you take there?
Yeah. From an internal perspective, I think step one is making sure that you tier the launch properly and then benchmarking it against similar tiers. So I hear this a lot, right? Of like within the first 2 weeks after launch, the weekly active users skyrocketed. It grew 1,000%. And it's like, well, that's not very fair if the product was in beta, like a closed beta or something, right? And then it went generally available and you announced it at, again, coming from a big company perspective, like something, you take a product from beta to GA at Adobe Summit. And then you look at the two weekly active instances and you're like, it grew 1,000% versus something that you're like, it was this one little feature and it got pushed out in a push notification and it only grew 20%. Okay, that's not fair. Like, one of these got top tier billing and is a new product. The other one is an existing product with maybe an existing set of users or whatever, right? So I think step one is internally benchmarking correctly in the correct tiers. I think the second thing is making sure that you're clear on the metrics. Are you looking at net new user acquisition? Are you looking at feature utilization, for example? Like, again, if it's a brand new product, versus an existing product, you shouldn't be using the same metrics. It would be probably a feature utilization or feature retention metric in the existing product for a feature launch versus a net new product where you're looking specifically at user acquisition, for example. So I think that's the second thing. I think the third thing is looking at the industry benchmarks. So this is another good example of having conversations like this, where it's like, I can reach out to you and be like, hey, Mary, you're also in a large company with a lot of products. I'm trying to just get a sense of what kind of coverage you got or what kind of utilization you got from this similar kind of thing, right? So talking to your peers, there's reports. Obviously, if you're at an enterprise company, you can look at things like the Magic Quadrant or the Wave to understand feature parity or core criteria for whatever the thing is that you're creating. So there's industry benchmarks. And then I know this is kind of controversial, but like, how'd it go for your competitors? What was the social sentiment when they launched something similar? Especially if it's something where it's a feature parity thing. AI is a perfect example of this. Everybody and their mother is doing something with AI. They're launching something with AI. So look at your competitive set, do some social listening to understand what was the sentiment, what was the reach, what was the press coverage. Obviously, you can't necessarily see the feature adoption or the acquisition in real time for them. And if they're not public, you might not ever see that, right? If they're raising a round of funding or if they're public, you might see monthly active user numbers or customer numbers. But you can see there's public information around press coverage or social media mentions, reach, sentiment that you could measure. And so you can do some benchmarking on that to understand how you're doing compared to the competitive set. So definitely some internal metrics across different things, some industry benchmarks, and then against the competitive set as well.
Thanks for giving a few different options, because I think that there often is analysis paralysis and people are so afraid to put a goal down if they've never done it before, or if they're kind of launching a new product line and don't have a new idea. It's like, the worst that can happen is you blow your goals, or you know what, you really miss it and you are given these caveats and kind of explain, you've never done this before. This is your new product line for you. You're kind of just pulling together the best educated guess that you can. But I think it's nice to have that, and then it'll fine tune and get better over time. So I think there's a lot of ways to do that. Love it. Always a good topic. Well, Ashley, I can't believe it's time already, but we're going to move to our Ashley spicy hot takes. So one question I had for you was, how do you think product marketing is going to change over the next 5 or 10 years?
This is a hard one, because I think product marketing is there. It's still kind of fuzzy of like what counts as a product marketer. I was just in some discussions where people are like, product marketing is not even marketing, it's strategy. And I was like, okay, I have opinions about that. Strategy and marketing are not separate. That's not a thing. That's not. So I do think it's interesting, particularly coming from Atlassian, where we grew a lot. A lot of our success for most of our tenure was around product-led growth. And so that connection between product marketing and product and that influence was very high. As we've grown and as we've targeted enterprises, now we do have that sales-led motion. And so product marketing plays a very different role, including sales enablement, you know, market enablement in terms of channels, partners, sales, et cetera. So I don't know. I think this is such a hard question to answer, because right now product marketing has such a broad definition, depending on the size of the company, the industry of the company, the stage of maturity in terms of like the market and the products. I do think that right now product marketing is kind of on the cusp of figuring out if they're generalists or specialists. And I mean, I know this is supposed to be my spicy take, but I'm curious for you, Mary, like, where do you think it's going to fall? Because most of the product marketers that I've dealt with and the style of product marketing that I've done has been very much generalist. It's like, you've got campaigns and you've got content and you've got social and you've got email and you've got competitive research and you've got onboarding and pricing. Like, it can encompass a lot of different things. And I am starting to see it move more in the direction of focusing in on being more of a specialist and having more influence over product, having more influence over pricing and packaging, rather than kind of doing all the things.
Yeah. Thanks for putting it back on me. I love a full stack product marketer. You know, I consider myself one. And I think once you get to a certain level, you've kind of just done all the things. So you're full stack. But you've got to have your thing. You've got to have like two or three things that you're just really freaking good at and that you love, I think, to make it more exciting. And I think depending on where you're at in the maturity of the product and what's happening in the business, et cetera, you're obviously going to have to lean in different areas. But I do think it is important for people to have the thing that they're known for and the thing that they can really hone in and be specialists on, and that you kind of build up your street cred about. So I think that's really important to do. And yeah, I hope you were talking about kind of the definition of product marketing. I hope it becomes a little bit more commonplace at organizations, and that there is a more of a definition that we can agree on at different companies, that it's not so, hey, I have to explain this to my CEO and everyone I work with if you're at a smaller company. So I hope that with more organizations like Sharebird and Product Marketing Alliance and just people talking about product marketing more, companies will get it, and you don't have to do a brown bag lunch about what is my job, which I've done at like pretty much every company I worked at. So I hope it just becomes more commonplace and we get understood.
Oh, yes. I believe in it.
I was waiting for you to ask the next question. I was like, who's interviewing here?
I know. And then I was like, oh, wait, no, still me, still back to me.
All right. So next hot take is, how should AI play a role in product marketing?
I think there is an excellent set of use cases for AI and product marketing. One of our, so she's working on the Atlassian AI offerings and kind of bringing those to market. She did a phenomenal internal session about how she's using other AI tools, you know, in spaces that are not our space, right? So one excellent example, she used it to basically like synthesize some data from sales calls. So taking Gong, where you've got all the transcripts and everything, and there's some pretty smart functionality in Gong already where you can look for different keywords or whatever, but that's an excellent use case for AI as well to say, okay, now I've filtered it down for my product or for a certain set of keywords, give me some summaries or summarize the top objections or summarize the sentiment of this conversation, right? So like, that's a really excellent example for that. A tool that we actually have internally that is super helpful, particularly at a large organization, is this AI feature where it'll basically define words and define acronyms for you. I think I posted this on LinkedIn a while back and I was like, how to trigger a marketer? And it was like, the TAM for this SKU for the ARR. And everyone was like, I know what you're saying, and it makes me sad in my soul, right? That like the total addressable market for this sales unit is with an annual recurring revenue, right? But like, if you're new to the organization, you might not know that. And so we actually have a feature in Confluence where it'll underline it and you can hover over it and it'll show you the definition of the acronym of the word, and then it'll link relevant pages, which is like excellent.
Oh my God. I swear it takes people like 6 months just to understand the acronyms here. So that is a huge learning curve. Wow. Okay. I love it.
So that's another good use case. I mean, that's not product marketing specific, but it's useful. And then also, I think there's a lot of opportunity to help with like building personas. So for example, we have a customer research team and a market research team, and they do these great write-ups. They pull in customer quotes and surveys and focus groups, and that's all super helpful information. And so having the ability to basically link to some of those pages and say, help us, like give us a first draft of a persona. And then obviously as product marketers, we would go in and say, okay, what are the key message and value props and product proof points? And are these actually the right titles? Like you would not just ship that as it is, but it's an easy way to take all of those excellent insights from maybe some partnership teams and have it build out like an initial draft for you. So those are a couple of ways that we're experimenting with it and using it internally. One use case that I'm using it for kind of on the product and content side of the house is repurposing. So take those excellent event sessions that you did and then get it to put it into an AI tool and get it to spit out 5 or 10 video clips that are 30 to 60 seconds long so that you can use those for social media or for landing pages, whatever. So there's a mix of like conceptual stuff, ways of working stuff, and then super tactical that we've been using it.
Amazing. Yeah. I think everyone I've had on the show and asked this question, they're using it. So basically it's like, use it, play around with it, first draft, thought partner, synthesizing information. It's not something you just hand over to your product team without ever reviewing it. Like, please don't do that. It's the wild, wild west a little bit still, but I think that I love hearing all of those different ideas. Those are really fun. All right, a couple more hot takes for you. How do you achieve work-life balance? Or should I ask, do you feel like you have balance?
Yeah, I'm like, step one, I don't actually believe in that. If you've heard the dichotomy between like work-life balance and work-life integration, I'm much more of a work-life integrator. I actually just had a post on LinkedIn this morning talking about context switching, like the context switching tax. And so I do think that knowing if you are a person that likes to do, like have your box where whatever it is, your working hours, you only focus on work and you don't make personal appointments, you don't take personal calls, you don't go on LinkedIn, like you're just doing that. That doesn't really work for me. I much prefer to answer Slack between sets at the gym, or if I'm at musical theater rehearsal and I'm stretching because I'm not needed on stage. Like, I don't find it stressful to check email during that time. So for me, it's more work-life integration. I do think the bigger question is also around energy management, and not in the like way, but like, if I'm doing something that gives me energy and it's not draining me, then I don't feel like I need to balance it. And so that's something I do a lot of things. I do fitness and baking and musical theater. All of those give me energy. And so it's kind of just that trade-off of, if I'm doing a show, I probably can't bake as much. If I'm baking a lot, I probably need to go to the gym more. So if I'm traveling a lot for work, then I don't audition for a show. So that's something, the open communication with my leadership to say, like, what do you foresee my travel schedule being over the next quarter? And then that way I can decide if I'm able to commit to doing a musical theater show or not. And just kind of leaning in, I know now when the busy seasons tend to be for my industry. And so I can do shows around that.
That is so cool. And I was thinking as we were talking that you must have a background in drama or theater because you're so poised. I see it coming through.
I thought it was going to be the facial expressions that are very extra.
It's more the props you're wearing. You know, people can't see this on the podcast, but you came up in full Wicked regalia. So I'm just kidding. What show are you? Are you in any shows that are upcoming?
Currently in a show. I just did Seussical, which is a musical based on the works of Dr. Seuss. Yeah. So I did that in the fall, which was fun. I was a very mischievous monkey in that show.
Oh my gosh. I love that. That's really, really cool. All right. So a couple more for you. What is the one thing that has been most important in terms of growing your career?
I think having a mix of managers and peers giving me direct feedback has been very helpful. I had one of the best managers, my manager at Duarte actually gave me some excellent feedback. I was having some troubles in a working relationship. And so I asked her to join me in a meeting. And I was like, I don't understand why this isn't going well. And we walked out of the meeting and she's like, you're the problem. And I was like, what? Thank you. You know, and she gave me very tactical feedback. She's like, you're approaching the problems in this way. This person approaches problems in this way. As the junior person, where this person is your stakeholder and effectively your customer, it's on you to bridge that gap. So here's like the three specific things that you need to do to bridge that gap. And so I did those three things and it worked, right? But like having somebody who was willing to bluntly tell me, it's me, here's why, and here's three suggestions to fix it, right? And I've had peers, I've gone to peers to say, I feel like I'm not communicating this effectively, or I'm not able to get buy-in, or something is wrong. What is it? And I'll send them the page and they're like, I don't know what any of this is. And I'm like, oh, okay. Like having people who are willing to build that trust with you and say, you're right, you can spot the problem, or you might recognize that there's a problem, but having people who aren't going to tiptoe around why I am missing the solution has been so helpful in growing my career. And I think figuring out how to be that person now that I'm managing teams and balancing that feedback, but the generic feedback of like, yeah, you just need to communicate better. I don't know what you mean. What specifically am I not doing that is causing this challenge? So I would say I've been very fortunate to have explicit feedback from multiple people throughout my career.
That is so priceless. And I feel like there is a little bit of fear sometimes in giving that feedback, but look how well you received it and how it really impacted your career. And it's taught you to seek out more feedback and kind of understand where those gaps are. So that is such priceless feedback and great, great advice for the guests here, for the listeners here. All right, last question for you. What is your favorite thing about product marketing?
I think my favorite thing is the fact that, at least the way I've done it and experienced it, it is the glue between everybody. And so, as I mentioned right at the start of this episode, I'm a generalist. I like to have my hands in everything. I like to connect those dots. And product marketing for me is the opportunity to really connect all of the four P's of marketing. You get to influence that product roadmap because you're bringing those customer insights. You get to think about the promotion side and that creative side and how do you get that message across. So for me, it's really that ability to connect all of those dots and being kind of the central hub of what the market needs, what the customers need, and then how the company can help provide that for them.
So amazing. I agree. Well, Ashley, it's been such a pleasure having you on the show. Please follow Ashley on LinkedIn. She has more hot takes and just awesome content. I am such a fan. And it's been just so wonderful having you here today. Thank you so much for giving us such a great conversation on women in product marketing.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And thanks for letting me put some of the questions back on you.
My pleasure. Thanks again. Women in Product Marketing is a Sharebird show, the site where leading product marketing execs answer questions and share best practices, including myself and our podcast guests. Sharebird makes it easy to search thousands of answers from the very best product marketers in the world around your daily challenges so you can get better outcomes. And the best part is it's free to join. Visit sharebird.com today.